Blog Talk Radio.
You got to listen to the Bob Carson Show. It's about the real deal. And this is Les Leopold, the author of Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice.
Hi, this is Stuart Acuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
I'm Andrew Craig. I'm an investigative reporter and attorney based in Washington, and I've the author of Presidential Puppetry, Obama, Romney, and Their Masters. And I want to encourage everyone to support, listen to, and talk about the Carson's Corner show in New Jersey, which is a pioneering, courageous, and apt voice for progressives in New Jersey that I first came to know in 2009 when he was the pioneering and virtually unique media outlet willing to take on Chris Christie, dig deep and look at how he had come to power and how he was misusing it. And 4 years, 5 years later here, that's all come to pass.
Hi, this is David K. Johnston, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
Hi, this is Harry Kaysen, member supporter of the Zeitgeist Movement. As Zeitgeist members, we know that it is virtually impossible to find sources in the media that speak truth to power. Well, Carson's Corner does just that, and it is one of those special places where you can find out what is really going on, not just what the bosses want you to know and think. So listen in and hear some truth at Carson's Corner. And oh, by the way, be sure to check out all the Zeitgeist and Zeitgeist-related films you can find on YouTube. We've got a world to save.
This is Greg Palin, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores, and you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio, radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hey, this is Frank Schaefer, author, writer, New York Times bestseller. But I'm here today because I've got a new book called Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. And I'm also on Carson's Corner because corporate media is so one-dimensional in terms of the kind of things they cover that they couldn't comprehend a discussion that would begin with a statement that implies a huge paradox. But I think there's a lot of thinking people out there who understand that life is paradoxical, and Carson's Corner is one of those places you can discuss it. So thanks for being with us.
Hi, everybody. This is Chris Driscoll here on another episode of Carson's Corner, the February 12th, Friday, February 12th edition. And want to welcome you all to on this cold. I mean, it is bitter cold, at least here in here in LeClaire, Iowa, where I'm broadcasting live. I don't even know how cold it is outside, but it feels like about 10 below with wind chill factor, maybe even colder. I mean, it is cold. You know, I think I've mentioned a few times in the past that that oftentimes I like to do the show from my porch, sitting out on the porch. I've got a lovely porch. It looks out over the Mississippi River. I feel so lucky. Never in my poverty, mostly poverty-stricken life, have I ever had such a view before. And so I like to sit out there and chat with you guys, chat with our good old buddy Bob from the porch, watching the Old Man River keep on rolling along. But tonight I'm going to be doing the show from inside because, I mean, this must be the coldest night of the year so far. It's really cold. And I guess in a way, you know, we've been kind of lucky, kind of lucky that that has been so warm. And I know that all of our friends out on the East Coast, where Bob Carson lives, have also been pretty lucky with a lot of warm days. You know, I guess it has something to do with El Nino, this being an El Nino year. Anyway, I should explain that I'm running solo here tonight. Bob, unfortunately, cannot be with us tonight. You know, I'm really going to miss him. I don't know, maybe he'll be able to find a way to call in for a few minutes, but, you know, we're going to miss Bob. I'm sure a lot of you people just tune in because Bob is, you know, such a nice guy and so informative, so articulate, and such a great, I mean, seriously, such a great guy, and such a great champion of the working class, a champion of socialism, democracy, you know, just, I mean, the kind of guy that, you know, like that old cliche that they use in politics, the guy you'd like to sit down and have a beer with. So anyway, because I'm running solo, I'm going to be kind of lonely, and I'd love to have any of you who'd like to do so, call in. The call-in number here is 347-326-9749. That's 347-326-9749. Give you a chance to write it down there. Go out and get a pencil, and I'll mention it again in just a few minutes because, I'd really love to have any of you call in tonight. We've got some, I think, some pretty interesting topics of conversation. Unfortunately, we weren't able to book a guest this week, although, you know, I did scramble around the last couple days trying, and I know Bob always tries, to find a good guest for you guys. I mean, last week, oh, what a show we had last week with Paul Street. I've got to tell you, I just think that Paul Street is such a brilliant guy and such a well-prepared guy. I mean, he blows me away. Got an article out today on counterpunch.org in which he interviews one of the Green Party candidates for the Green Party nomination for president, Jill Stein. I think most people think that Dr. Stein. She's a pediatrician, I believe. Dr. Stein is the front runner in the Green primary contest, primary and caucus contest. So she will probably, when the Greens have their convention this summer, she will probably end up being the Green Party nominee for president. And Paul Street did a wonderful interview with her talking about, you know, for instance, why someone might want to vote for Jill Stein instead of, say, for instance, Bernie Sanders. A superficial look would give you the idea that the two have pretty similar platforms. However, you know, of course, Jill Stein is not, you know, an out-and-out supporter of militarism and imperialism like Bernie Sanders is. Jill Stein, I don't believe, would ever vote year after year after year after year for the money to fund these really tragic wars that the imperialists seem to keep coming up with. And Obama, as the latest imperial president, or as I call him, the Emperor Obama, you know, he's had six major wars that he's been involved in. This is the guy who won the Nobel Peace Prize, you know. I think they give him something like $250,000 or something like that for being, you know, a promoter of peace. Well, excuse me, I just don't see that. I mean, you know, I think that's the reason people don't take the Nobel Prize very seriously anymore, at least not the Peace Prize. You know, I mean, they have other prizes. They have the prizes for physics, for chemistry, for economics, you know, and so forth and so on. And I guess some of those are well-deserved. But obviously when you have people like Henry Kissinger, I mean, you know, did you guys hear the or see the Democratic Party presidential debate last night where Bernie Sanders took Hillary Clinton to task for touting the wisdom of Henry Kissinger? I mean, you know, for Christ's sake, give me a break. That was just laughable. I mean, it's laughable looking at Hillary Clinton, who's supposed to be a liberal, right? I mean, you know, and frankly, I think she is a liberal because she acts like every damn liberal in power has acted over the last century, you know, meaning that she acts imperialist and capitalist like every liberal has acted when they get in power. I mean, that seems to be their, you know, that seems to be their MO, doesn't it? That they're, you know, that they kind of, they act pretty badly, the liberals, I mean, when they get into power. But anyway, without further ado, I think we've already kind of gotten into it. Before we launch into the first topic, though, let me once again repeat the call-in number. We'd love to have you guys call in, chat with us. 347-326-9749. Anyway, you know, I guess the first topic I wanted to raise, and I've already mentioned it, and that is the Democratic Party debate last night. I think it came to us from Milwaukee. Milwaukee is a kind of an interesting town, by the way, because in the 40s and 50s, I guess, they actually had a socialist mayor, Milwaukee. I think the, let me see if I can remember the guy's name, Feidler, was the Socialist Party mayor of Milwaukee for many, many years. And you know, it's kind of an interesting town, certainly a working class town, you know, a factory town. Those of you who are older like me will remember Laverne and Shirley, the show Laverne and Shirley, where they came from Milwaukee, or Happy Days, you know, with Richie Cunningham and the Fonz and so forth. They were, I believe they were in Milwaukee too. And, you know, of course they were in Milwaukee during the 50s and early 60s when Feidler was the mayor, when they had a socialist mayor, which I don't believe that they ever mentioned that on either of those television shows, but go figure, you know. I guess you're not supposed to mention socialism, although nowadays, you know, with Bernie Sanders running for office, it gets mentioned quite often. So, and that's good because, you know, the stats, the statistics, the polls say that 36% of Americans are leaning towards socialism rather than capitalism. They say that 48% of the youngsters, of the people 29 and below, 18 to 29, I guess, lean towards socialism. They're expressing really great interest in socialist ideas, and I believe personally that that's a big part of the reason that Bernie Sanders is getting the kind of reception that he's getting. I mean, Bernie, you know, Bernie's been calling himself a democratic socialist for decades, and finally he looked around and he saw, hey, here's this golden chance for me to run for president because all these people are expressing interest in socialism. I can get out there and tell them what socialism is. You know, and of course, Bernie Sanders and I disagree. Bob and I have both talked about this, and, you know, some of our other guests have also talked about. I think Paul Street did a really good job last week talking about the fact that what Bernie Sanders calls democratic socialism is really social democracy. It's not socialism at all. I mean, and it's hardly even social democracy. But anyway, this debate last night, how many of you saw it? If any of you, if you've got comments on it, please call in and talk to us at 347-326-9749. And give us your views on the debate last night. I've got to say, first of all, you know, I found it entertaining. I was talking to my very good friend, Linda Shade, very close friend of mine, lives in Maryland. I was talking to her this morning about it, and she said she found it really interesting and entertaining, and I said I found it entertaining too. I mean, I think it must have been the most feistiest of the debates so far on the Democratic Party side, or within the Democratic Party nomination process. And what did they talk about? Well, I mean, I guess we could just throw out some words there that you know, Wall Street, you know, and Wall Street money. They talked about the cops, the police, you know. I mean, we've talked on this show before about the tremendous problem we have with militarized police forces running roughshod over our cities today. You know, and they talked about, FDR and Winston Churchill. You know, Bernie said FDR was his, you know, his model of a great guy from the 20th century. They asked him, you know, who were you two influential people from the 20th century? And Bernie said, you know, that about FDR. And then he said it also, he said about Winston Churchill. And, you know, more on Winston Churchill a little bit later, but, I mean, I think the guy was a war criminal, first of all. So in my opinion, in my humble opinion, I'm backed up on this by none other than Noam Chomsky. Noam Chomsky also feels that FDR was a war criminal. You know, we can get into that a little bit later. Hillary Clinton, though, she didn't much talk last night about her own positions, did she? I mean, her own, it wasn't really her emphasis last night to talk about her own platform. Seemed like more of her emphasis was to talk about how Bernie Sanders' platform is unrealistic. It's pie in the sky. It's fantasy. It's, you know, the numbers don't add up, so-called. I mean, you know, that was a case when they were talking about, for instance, national health insurance, which some people call single payer. You know, and they were talking about Britain, which actually it does not have national health insurance. Britain has basically socialist medicine, a socialist medical system in which the government owns the all the clinics and hospitals and so forth, and people, you know, just go to the doctor, and the government pays for it because the government owns it. That's quite a bit different than the single payer that the National Health Insurance expanded Medicare that Bernie Sanders talks about, because Bernie Sanders, you know, is talking about a social insurance, social health insurance program, as opposed to a health service that's owned and operated by the government. Britain has a health service that's owned by the government, and Canada, as a for instance, also France, they both have national health insurance, is government-owned health insurance that's pretty similar to Medicare here in the United States, or Medicaid. Medicare, for instance, it's an 80-20 plan, and with that 80-20 plan, you end up paying 20% of everything, and the government ends up paying 80% of everything. So it's really like you've got insurance to cover 80% of your medical costs, and then you're stuck paying the 20%. That's the way U.S. Medicare works. That's also the way the social insurance system in France works. It's also an 80-20 plan, which, frankly, I don't like. I think, you know, if you're going to go all the way and try to, you know, give coverage to everybody, why not just give coverage to everybody, full coverage, you know? That's why I like the Canadian system better. And I really, to tell you the truth, I even like the British system or the Cuban system even better, because in Britain and in Cuba, the government just outright owns the doctors. They own the nurses. They own the clinics, you know, the doctor's office, whatever. And it's a lot less complicated because you just walk down the street to your local doctor, or, you know, I think in Britain at least, you're allowed to pick another doctor. If you don't like the one that's down the street, you can, you know, walk another few blocks to the next one. But you just have to sign up for some doctor, and then you go in, and they see you when you need to be seen. There's no fuss, no muss. There's no money passed. You just go in. But here's the ticket. Here's the thing that I think Bernie Sanders should have said, but he really didn't say it forcefully enough. I think he should have said, Madam Secretary, you claim that the mathematics is wrong, the arithmetic's wrong, the numbers don't add up. But the fact of the matter is that the British National Health Service covers everybody for free. Nobody pays anything except in their taxes. And it costs the British society one half of what it costs the American society to pay for this nonsensical, convoluted, privatized private health insurance that we're forced to buy. I mean, imagine that. We're forced to buy a faulty, privately owned, capitalist product. That's Obamacare's solution. You know, Obamacare is force everybody to buy faulty products from private companies. You know, that's just wrong. It doesn't work very well. And we pay twice as much and still end up with 20 million people who don't have health insurance. And then Bernie could have said, Madam Secretary, let's also look at Canada, in which everybody has national health insurance. Also, they get that for free. They just pay for it in their taxes. And it costs the Canadian society one-third less than the American system of private health insurance costs us. So there's your arithmetic. Simple. But in any case, the Democratic Party debate last night, I found it entertaining, sad at the same time. It was sad and entertaining, you know, and sad and entertaining. You know, CNN politics, they called that part of the debate, what did they call it here? Hold on a second. Revolution versus reality, as though Secretary of State, Madam First Lady Hillary Clinton was right. You know, she was on the reality and Bernie was on the revolution, so it's revolution versus reality. And that seemed to be a major, you know, kind of a major kind of, it's a major kind of a message, let's say, that that Hillary Clinton was pushing last night. I mean, her message wasn't so much, look at my great plan. It was, look at Bernie Sanders' fantasy land plan, you know, as though, you know, what Sanders says. And in a way, you know, there's always a little kernel of truth in each side in these kind of things. The kernel of truth in almost called her Senator Clinton, in Secretary Clinton's contentions, the kernel of truth there was, well, it's not realistic. It's that you can't get this passed in the American system. Well, you know what? She's absolutely true. You cannot get Bernie-style social democracy passed given the fact that the American ruling class is in power, and they won't stand for it. They haven't in the last 40 years since they started rolling back the few social programs that America once had. You know, America under kind of what we used to call social liberals, used to be a thing called social liberals. They weren't like the liberals today who are just old-fashioned. Some people call them neoliberal, you know, or new-fashioned, but they're really just old-fashioned, pre-Keynesian, prior to the advent of social democracy, liberals. I mean, they're liberals who, you know, they're just out for a more pure, unadulterated, brutal imperialism and brutal capitalism. That's what the liberals used to be before FDR, for instance, came along in the 1930s and adopted a couple of, a small, like, social democratic light version of social democracy. That's why we call them social liberals instead of social democrats, because the social liberals, you know, they offered an even weaker, you know, kind of watered-down version of social democracy. And, that went along for about 30 years. It went on, the 30s, 40s, 50s, into part of the 60s, up until about 1965, 66 maybe. And then it all went to hell. Social liberalism went to hell because, starting out, it went to hell because of the war. And as Dr. Martin Luther King used to say, you can't have social justice and have these wars going on. The wars will eat up the war on poverty. It will eat up all the money for the war on poverty. And that's exactly what happened. So initially, social democracy and its watered-down cousin, social liberalism, got wiped out in the mid-60s. But there were still a lot of advocates of social liberalism in Congress, in the Democratic Party. And so it wasn't really until the presidency of Jimmy Carter, where a full-fledged kind of what they call these days, they call it new liberalism or neoliberalism. It's a kind of a super imperialist economic policy, an imperialist economic policy on steroids, basically. And that's what some academics call that neoliberalism. Some leftists you hear, like, for instance, our good buddy Paul Street last week was referring to it as neoliberalism. This neoliberalism, it's really kind of a throwback to the old days of liberalism before social liberalism came along. And anyway, this new liberalism, especially starting under Jimmy Carter, started going into full force, you know. And what we hear these terms like austerity. Austerity is kind of like, you know, like the forefront of neoliberalism. Or we hear these terms, some of you might have heard the term structural adjustment. Structural adjustment is basically a plan that's put forward by the U.S.-controlled International Monetary Fund and the U.S. European-controlled World Bank, where basically anybody that wants to get loans from these international institutions has to adapt these structural adjustment programs wherein they fuck their own working class. You know, they squeeze the working class, they fire tens of thousands. You can see it just this year in what Syriza, the so-called socialist government of Greece, has been forced to do. They've been forced to fire tens of thousands of government workers. They've been forced to drastically reduce the social services to their elderly, the retirement, social security, and so forth. just in general, what it comes down to, austerity and structural adjustment comes down to is, we're going to squeeze the fuck out of you. We're going to squeeze the blood out of you. It's kind of like what the great Malcolm X used to say back when he was alive, before he was assassinated by the American government, by the FBI. He used to say, show me a capitalist and I'll show you a bloodsucker. Think about it. I mean, that's really, really, that's true. That's so true. You know, show me a capitalist and I'll show you a bloodsucker. So, you know, that is what the American ruling class, capitalist imperialist ruling class, pushes all around the world, and all of the other ruling classes, especially in the other kind of junior imperialist countries like Britain, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, Japan, Australia, you know, these are kind of what I consider to be junior partners in imperialism with the Americans, with the American ruling class in the lead. And all of these ruling classes around the world agree on one thing, and that is that especially since the 1970s, that they are never, ever, ever going to allow for Bernie Sanders style or Syriza style or Jeremy Corbyn style social democracy. It's just not going to happen anymore. I got into quite a spirited debate just this afternoon with a couple of my old friends. Both these two guys are Trotskyists, I guess they say that they're Trotskyists anyway. Most of you probably don't even know what the hell a Trotskyist is, but it's a person who follows the theoretical framework, let's say, that was created by Leon Trotsky, who was one of the leaders of the Russian Revolution. Trotsky kind of stood out with his own unique set of ideas that some people to this day still follow. I don't follow it. I used to when I was a really, really young man, like, you know, up to about 35 years ago, and then I moved on to what I consider to be better alternatives. But anyway, these two guys, these two friends of mine, who calls himself a Trotskyist, he supports Bernie Sanders, and he thinks it's a good idea, and he thinks all the left and all the socialists should support Bernie Sanders. And, you know, I've got to say, I really, you know, I don't fault people like that. I've got lots of friends who feel that way. My own daughter feels that way. My own beloved niece feels that way. She's a, you know, what I call a Bernie bot, you know, somebody who loves Bernie. And I really, really do understand why these people are excited about Bernie Sanders. You know, I really do. I think I've said this before on the show. I understand why they why they like Bernie so much. You know, it's wishful thinking, basically. It's dream fulfillment. It's, you know, wouldn't it be so much nicer? I mean, they look and they see there are social democratic countries out there, you know, where, you know, let's take the Scandinavian countries where mothers get 3 or 6 months off when they have a baby of, you know, family leave so they can take care of their baby. Fathers get off to help take care of their baby for several months. You know, everybody gets free education. They can go to college and not come out with mountains and mountains of student debt. People when they're unemployed, you know, like take for Germany, for instance, where I believe used to be at least, they got 5 years of unemployment. I believe still in Britain today, you get unemployment as long as you're unemployed. They call it the dole. So, you know, I mean, that seems like kind of a dream to Americans, you know. So what Bernie Sanders talks about, I understand why people like my daughter, people like my good friend that I'm just talking about there, people like my niece, loads and loads of young people around the country who are really under the gun these days, just weeks from the streets, you know, living hand-to-hand, mouth-to-mouth. I mean, they're, it's not such an easy life out there. It's nowhere near as easy as it was when I was a kid back in the 70s. I'll tell you that. It's a lot harder today for young people. And so I really understand why they're excited about Bernie Sanders. And I hate to be the bearer of ill tidings, the guy that brings the bad news, but just as I was saying earlier, the ruling class in this country is not going to allow it. So the only way forward is not through voting our way out of this, because we can't. The only way forward is through revolution. Revolution is the only solution. I say that to people quite often. You know, it's a slogan. It's just supposed to be kind of a catchy phrase that catches in your brain, and I hope it does, but it really has some great meaning. Revolution, in this case, is the only solution, because the wealthy, the billionaire class, they won't allow for anything other than that. They won't allow us to kind of, you know, reform our way out of this miserable situation. They won't even allow for the kinds of social services that we had in the United States in the 1960s, which were really not that great. They were just, you know, compared to now, they were a lot better, but compared to what social democratic countries in the north of Europe have, they're really kind of pathetic and laughable, you know. But look, even in Europe today, a lot of these social services, a lot of these social benefits that people took for granted for generations have been rolled back or cut or substantially, you know, curtailed. It's a sad thing. It really is. It's really a sad thing, but, you know, it's true, ladies and gentlemen. It's true. It's true, men and women. It's true, all you kids out there. It really is true. It's not possible. And that's what this debate that I had with these friends of mine, these two Trotskyists, was all about. The one Trotskyist agrees with me that, you know, it's just not possible anymore, that Bernie Sanders-style socialism is not possible. And the other one holds out hope for Bernie. And, you know, like I say, I don't fault him for it, even though I do feel he's an older, he's not as old as me, he's in his 50s, so he's been around a while, let's say. He's been around the block a few times, and I felt like he should know better. But I guess apparently he doesn't. And as we've talked about several times on the show, we've talked about this idea that excuse me, I'm getting a little bit of a frog in my throat there. We've talked about this idea that that revolution is really the only solution. We've talked about it not just tonight. We've talked about it several times in the past. And, as, you know, we're not just being obstinate. We're not just being, you know, like the skunk at the party, so to speak, or you know, the guy who wakes up naked in the classroom from his dream or whatever. We're not being that guy. We're just relating to you what our study of the way the system works tells us. And the way the system works, it tells us that Bernie-style democratic socialism, as he calls it, or as you know everybody else in the world calls it, social democracy, or social liberalism. The reason the social liberals have been, you know, pushed out of politics, there hasn't been a social liberal president in the United States, I mean, for almost half a century, since I guess you'd have to say that in an ironic sense, you know, Richard Nixon was the last social liberal president, even though he's considered, at that time, he was considered to be a really terrible conservative. But a lot of the programs that he pushed, like, for instance, you know, a guaranteed income for everybody, or, you know, he actually pushed a social insurance, social health insurance plan, both of which failed. But, you know, he's probably the last social liberal president. And the last person who, like, claimed to be a social liberal was Johnson. That's quite a long time ago. I mean, that's what Johnson was president up until 1968. Let me see, 70, 80, 90. I mean, that's almost 50 years ago. I think in 2018, that'll have been 50 years ago that Johnson was president. That's a hell of a long time ago. And overall, this time, the capitalist class who chooses who's going to be president and chooses most of the people in the Congress, they haven't allowed a single social liberal to be president in all that time. Why is that? Why is it that you look today and in the entire Congress, I think Bob told us last week there was, or the week before maybe, that there was 535 members of the Senate and the House of Representatives. Out of that 535 people, you know, we have maybe 10 of them are social liberals. Maybe 10. I've actually met a few of them. I met Bernie Sanders, of course. He's a social liberal. John Conyers, you know, there's a couple of the women, I think maybe Barbara Boxer, I'm not sure. A couple others that are social liberals. But, you know, social liberals really don't get into power in the United States today. If Bernie Sanders gets into power, if he's actually elected president, I mean, that'll be, you know, phenomenal in and of itself, because it'll be the first time in 50 years that we've had a social liberal as president. And even then, I don't believe for a minute that the ruling class in the United States is going to allow Bernie Sanders to get away with actually, or to, you know, allow the Congress to actually pass any real socially beneficial legislation, or, you know, if they did, they'd just put it to Bernie Sanders, you know, that's a no-go, veto it. You know, kind of like what they did to Alex Tsipras of Syriza party in Greece this past summer. Those of you who've been listening to Carson's Corner with the election boycott advocates for some time, you probably followed along with all the discussions we had about Greece and Alex Tsipras, who's the prime minister in Greece, and the Syriza party, which is a socialist or claims to be a socialist party. They won the election last January. Not even last January. I'm not correct in that. The January of last year, so a year and a month ago, they won the election, and everybody was all excited. I mean, I got to tell you, I got swept up in it, too. I was excited, too. Bob was excited. Thomas, you know, our good old friend Thomas, Thomas Baldwin, he was excited. All of us were excited because we all felt like, hey, you know, at least finally something good's happening. Finally a victory for the working class. Unfortunately, early in the summer or late in the spring last year, Alex Tsipras was called before the ruling bankers of the European Union, and basically, we don't know exactly what they told him. I mean, personally, I suspect that they told him that his government was going to be overthrown by a CIA MI6 coup d'etat, a violent coup d'etat, a violent military coup d'etat, if he didn't capitulate. So all of a sudden, here's this guy who had spent all his life being kind of a radical socialist, you know, who'd promised to do away with all the terrible, terrible austerity that was crushing the working class in Greece. And overnight, I mean, for Christ's sake, overnight, he capitulated. He gave in to all the demands of the banksters. I say that with an S-T-E-R, bankster. All the banksters, the criminal bankers, he gave in to all their demands and started doing what the last government, which was also a social democratic government in Greece, had been doing. You know, he crushed. He went back to crushing the working class. So, you know, that's not so cool. Really, it's not so cool. But that's what he did, you know. That's what he did. And there isn't a hell of a lot, you know, that we can do about it. But, you know, let's face it. The ruling class just won't allow for this anymore. But back to the debate. I'm kind of you know, surprised that nobody's called in to talk about this debate. Maybe that's not the real issue that people are into. You know, I had said that we're going to talk about Beyonce and talk about a couple of other issues. The call-in number, by the way, is 347-326-9749. That's 347-326-9749. And, of course, all of you guys, any of you guys are welcome to call in and chat, to bring up your own, you know, kind of look at things, your own kind of view, you know, of things. You know, I think I'm going to need a little break here. Looking for through Bob's. Bob has like a long list of, you know, really excellent kind of things to put on here. So I'm going to take a little break and let you read one or listen to one of these things that Bob's got up here while I go give my myself a break. And please, you know, before I go on break, let me just say once again, feel free to call in at 347-326-9749, and we'll chat some more. Let me see if I can find one of these break things that will give me just the appropriate time. It's an interesting thing with Gar Alperovitz that I might run, but it's a little bit long. Here's something with, you know, we were talking about Jill Stein, that's about, let me see, 6 minutes and 40 seconds. Let's run this Jill Stein thing because I think, you know, we were talking about that earlier, so this will give you guys a chance to listen to Dr. Jill Stein, the 2012 candidate for what is a candidate for president for the Green Party, and she's trying to, you know, get that again. So let me just run that here, and you can listen to Jill Stein, and I'll be back in just a little over 6 minutes.
It's a pleasure.
Get this going.
So exactly, Dennis, I know you act obviously from Acronym TV and whatnot, and you have recently running or managing Jill's campaign and whatnot.
Right, so I'm not managing the campaign. I'm serving as the communications director for the campaign. I'm really excited to be part of a political campaign that's committed to bringing the voices of frontline communities into the front lines of the presidential debate and the dialogue. This is more about movement building than it is about traditional electoral politics, about building capacity for real radical change and transformation that needs to happen in this United States. It's something that's not going to happen from within the Democrats, certainly within the Republican Party, certainly not nothing that's going to happen within the status quo. So we need something really radical to change now, and Jill is our best shot to make that happen.
Absolutely. We've spoken a lot about you on our podcast. I do a podcast with the Election Boycott Advocates with Chris Driscoll. He was Nader's communication director for many, many years. And how do you respond to people out there that say, you know what, Jill Stein unfortunately doesn't have a chance. She's going up against the two major political parties out there, so much financial backing and whatnot, and the system itself. How do you respond to that notion?
Well, I would say that the issue is not the candidate. You know, the issue is the everyday people out there, because from that point of view, they don't have a chance. They don't have a chance for jobs. They don't have a chance for a fair trade agreement. They don't have a chance for a health care system that actually provides health care instead of sick care that makes us bankrupt. They don't have a chance for achieving, you know, some kind of a foreign policy based on international law and human rights. Students don't have a chance of getting out of debt. You know, it's like the issue here is not, you know, who can run for office. The issue is, do we have a society and a world that's working for everyday people? Right now we don't, and we don't have an option for that through either of the corporate-sponsored Wall Street parties. So we know that a majority of people, number one, disapprove. There's majority disapproval of both the Democratic and the Republican parties, and that there is majority desire, stated desire, for a third-party campaign. I'd say a major third-party political party for the long haul. So we got the numbers on our side. You know, even before you get down to the issues, which also drive the numbers. One out of every two Americans is in poverty or low income, heading for poverty. One out of every three African Americans is held hostage by the prison industrial complex and the police state. 40 million young people, millennials, are in debt. Current and former students in debt with no option to get out of it, with most of the jobs now since the meltdown, the economic meltdown, being low-wage, temporary, part-time jobs. This is not a situation we can live with, you know, and the meltdown of the climate, needless to say. If those groups got together, in fact, if only millennials who are in debt decided they were going to go to the polls in 2016, November, and vote themselves out of debt, just do that, you know what? We would have enough votes right then and there to actually win the election.
Do you think that the fact that Hillary Clinton is obviously running and you've got Bernie Sanders that threw his hat into the race, that the discussion is going to kind of drift more towards issues that you've been talking about for many, many years?
I think Bernie will help drive that.
Yeah.
Exactly. Now, at the end of the day, Bernie has already pledged allegiance to Hillary Clinton, or whichever centrist Democrat wins the race.
Right.
So we really want to get the word out to people who are asking what to do with their progressive politics and their vision and their courage. While the Sanders campaign is going to speak truth to power, that's a great thing. But at the end of the day, you don't want your hard-won movement to simply be handed over to Hillary Clinton.
Right.
So I'd really encourage people to think about what you're going to do with your hard-won energy and your dollars and your canvassing. Do you want to deliver them to an organization that will in turn just merge with Hillary Clinton?
Right, right.
Or do you want to build resistance for the long haul? What Bernie is doing is a part of a long tradition of rebellions inside of the Democratic Party, starting with Jesse Jackson, which was the most powerful rebellion certainly in our day. But when push came to shove and he did not get the nomination, he endorsed Hillary Clinton. So his organization folded. What does that, you know, what does that create? That basically creates kind of a dead weight inside the Democratic Party, because it blocks the development of long, you know, of enduring resistance outside of the Democratic Party. These rebellion campaigns inside the Democrats just get swallowed up whole by the monster of the Democratic Party. They are absolutely silenced. They are erased from existence. Hillary Clinton might nudge her rhetoric, and that's all it will be, her rhetoric, just for long enough to ensure that she gets the nomination, and then it will all be, you know, history, like it never happened. And that, in turn, will prevent the development of a real opposition base from which we can build. That's the work that we need to do. Build for the long haul, not just 9 months. This is a fight. This is a fight that needs to go on, you know, really for the rest of our lives. So we got to start building productively. Let's not build, fly-by-night organizations that are here today and gone tomorrow. We need to build for the long haul. So I'd really encourage people to go to Jill2016.com and check out the opposition that won't go away and pledge allegiance to Hillary Clinton.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I appreciate everything.
Thank you so much, Bob, for being the real media at the end of the day. We don't need the O-press, we call them, or the re-press, or the D-press.
Yeah.
We need real press. It's fundamental to our democracy. Thank you so much, Bob Carson, for making that happen.
Appreciate it. All right, great. I'm going to get some people.
Okay. I'm back with you. This is Chris Driscoll here on Carson's Corner. excuse me, I'm a little out of breath. I had to run back in to pick the show up. But here we are again after listening to Dr. Jill Stein, the 2012 presidential candidate of the Green Party, and a candidate in the Green Party primaries and caucuses for the nomination for the 2016 presidential election as well. We'll see this summer how Dr. Jill does there. Good luck to her. You know, I know most of the Greens I've talked to intend on voting for Dr. Stein in their caucuses. I think most of the Green parties around the country caucus, like the Democrats and Republicans do here in Iowa. A couple of states where the Greens are pretty big, like California, where last I looked, there were like 130,000 Greens registered in California. So they have a primary. And all those Green folks will have the chance to vote for Dr. Jill Stein to promote her as the candidate for the Green Party in the general elections. I have no clue how many ballot lines the Green Party will get this year. My guess is that they'll probably get 24 to 30 ballot lines, be on the ballot in 24 to 30 states. I know in my own experience of working for three Ralph Nader campaigns for president, one of which, 2000, he was the candidate of the Green Party, and two of which, 2004 and 2008, he was an independent candidate. In 2008, if memory serves, we got on the ballot in 46 out of the 50 states, which is a hell of a lot better than the Greens do. you know, I'll tell you, it was a monumental effort. All of us in the Nader campaign were working, you know, 12, 14, 16, 18 hours a day. I mean, some of these young folks, I'm an oldster, but some of the younger people, I mean, I don't think they slept for days at a time sometimes. Quite a thrilling experience, but exhausting as well. It's a good kind of exhausting, though, I guess. You know, but you know, the one thing I notice in Dr. Stein's little discussion there that Bob had with her, I believe that came from this past summer's Left Forum in New York City. Bob ran into a number of folks at that Left Forum, and one of them was Jill Stein. He jumped at the opportunity of getting an interview with her. But the one thing, you know, like when she's talking about if all the folks that are in debt, you know, the whatever it is, 40, 50 million people who have enormous student debt in the United States, you know, if all those people would go out and vote that, you know, that they could vote away the student debt. And God, how I wish they would do that, because so many people are just snowed under by this idiotic debt that should not exist, because we should have free education. It's just that simple. You know, every country that has anything near the GDP of the United States has free education, except for the United States and maybe one or two other countries. I mean, the British used to have it up until about 10 years ago, and then the Labor Party, of all things, the Labor Party got rid of it, and they introduced what was supposed to be a small tuition for people going to the publicly owned schools in Britain. And now, I mean, the last I've heard, it's as outrageous as it is in the United States with public schools. You know, some public schools in the United States are charging like $20,000 a year for tuition alone, and that doesn't include the books, which can be another, God only knows, $10,000 or whatever. It's ridiculous. You know, these books, for instance, it's just ridiculous. I mean, the universities in this country should get together. They should directly hire writers, you know, good, competent academic writers to write good, competent academic textbooks and put them online for the kids to use for free. That's what should be happening. There's no reason that it isn't happening other than pure greed, other than the greed of these people, you know, thinking they can. You know, I noticed Bernie Sanders last night said that he would do away with the onerous student debt. Hillary Clinton didn't offer to join him. But there again, you know, without revolution, it's not going to happen. And that's why I wanted to bring this up with Jill Stein, you know. Jill, she sounds like a wonderful person. You know, I have a few friends who've met her, who know her, and who tout her, who promote her. I don't want to offend anybody, but that's kind of funny, actually. You guys who listen regularly, you probably know that I can get pretty offensive on these things. But, no, seriously, I don't want to offend anybody who loves Jill Stein, but the fact of the matter is, in my opinion, and this is opinion backed up by lots of facts, by lots of by the history of 50 years that I was just talking about, where the ruling class just has not allowed these kinds of social services, these kinds of socially beneficial programs to be passed in the United States. And it's not for lack of trying. It's not for lack of labor, women's groups, you know, other workers' groups, progressive third parties and so forth, all trying their damnedest. And these are talented people. I mean, they're not, you know, they're not idiots. They're really and frankly no worse than the organizers of the 1930s were. And the organizers of the 1930s were able to force the ruling class through great struggles, through sometimes struggles that led to blood in the streets, but they were able to force the ruling class to concede at least some small crumbs from the ruling class table, some small social services, social benefits, you know. That's when, for instance, Social Security was first enacted. They were able to force them to do it then. And you know what? Those people weren't any better than we are, frankly. And they're wonderful people. I mean, I knew a lot of them. I mean, I one of my closest friends, I think I've talked about this before on the show, but one of my closest friends, Irv Riskin, who was a social justice activist for all his life. He died last summer. He was 94 years old. And, God, the stories that guy used to tell about the 30s, about the struggles that he was in the labor movement. He lived in Michigan during the 1930s and worked for, the auto workers' struggles. He himself was in the CIO, Federal Workers Union, Federal Office Employees Union, something like that. He was a great guy. But you know what? I mean, I know a lot of guys that are in their 20s. Or people in their, you know, 30s, late 30s, like Bob, for instance. Bob Carson, the guy who's on our show here normally. They're just as good, and they're just as committed. The difference is what they're up against today. What they're up against today is, what they're up against today is quite a bit different than what they were up against in the 1930s, even though in the 1930s it was a depression. What they're up against today is a ruling class that is tenacious in its determination, in its staunch refusal to allow for any kind of benefits that will help working class people. It's just that simple. And I think that it's a conscious strategy on the part of the global ruling class. I think that we can see that this, you know, this has been going on for 40 years now. This, you know, situation where all of the, pretty much all of the social liberals have been pushed to the side, and the only kind of liberals we get today are the old-fashioned liberals, or what a lot of people call the neo-liberals or neocons. Pretty much the same thing when you think about it. I mean, I always tell people, in my opinion, there's not a dime's bit of difference between most of the economic positions and most of the military militant positions, most of the imperialist positions that the neocons and the neo-libs have, or, you know, frankly, what I just like to call liberals and conservatives. They're not a dime's bit of difference between them, seriously. I mean, they put on a good show as though they're actually arguing, you know, over this stuff. But, you know, think about it. When the liberals get in power, do they really, you know, take everybody's guns away like the conservatives say they're going to? I mean, everybody I know who had guns when the conservatives were in power, they still have the same number of guns now. Do the conservatives, when the conservatives get into power, do they all of a sudden, you know, take away Roe versus Wade and take away the right of a woman to choose to have an abortion if that is what she needs to do or is forced to do in her circumstances? No, the conservatives have yet to done that. George Bush didn't do it all the time he was president. You know, George Bush's father, George Herbert Walker Bush, he didn't do it when he was president. Reagan didn't do it when he was president. So, you know, a lot of this boogeyman scare tactic stuff that the conservatives use against the liberals and the liberals use against the conservatives, it's just hogwash. It's not real, because in reality, you know, the liberals and the conservatives, the neocons and the neo-libs, they do the bidding of the ruling class. It's that simple. And that's why they seem so similar. That's why, you know, I had to laugh last night, too, just speaking of the debate, when Hillary Clinton, you know, she's talking about what was it now? I'm forgetting it, but it'll come back to me anyway. I'll mention it a little bit later. But in the meantime, I mean, people will try, these liberals and conservatives, they will try to scare the living hell out of you. I mean, Hillary Clinton right now, she's trying to scare the living hell out of you with this argument. Her argument is, well, you know, I can win against the Republicans, but, you know, Bernie Sanders can't. So we'll end up with Republicans if you vote for Bernie Sanders. Even though all the polls show that Bernie Sanders wins against any of the leading Republicans by a wider margin than Hillary Clinton does. So, So, I mean, you know, the facts aren't there for Clinton, but she's still trying to use this boogeyman kind of argument, you know. And they will use it. I mean, because in the end, in my humble opinion, as I said last week, as Paul Street said last week, in the end, Bernie Sanders is going to end up losing in the primaries. Even though, you know, Sanders has tied one caucus that was here in Iowa and has overwhelmingly won the New Hampshire primary, Hillary Clinton is ahead, quite substantially ahead, in the delegate count. Why is that? Because Hillary Clinton's got all these so-called superdelegates. I think we talked about that, what they are, last week. And she's got all these superdelegates. So even though Bernie has won or tied the two races so far, Hillary's winning. That's your democracy for you, you know. and I think it's going to continue to be that way. I think it's going to be some close races, but Hillary Clinton's going to end up, you know, having more delegates at the convention than Bernie. And Bernie Sanders has already promised that if Hillary Clinton wins the nomination, that he will do what every other progressive, quote, progressive, unquote, who's run in the Democratic primaries of the last several decades has done, and that is he will line up behind and support Hillary Clinton. And if, you know, there's this big difference between them, why is it? If there's this big difference between them, why the hell is it that even with the big difference, Bernie is still going to line up behind Hillary? And that's why the great Glenn Ford from Black Agenda Report called Bernie a sheepdog. And you know what a sheepdog does? A sheepdog is like a cowboy. The sheepdog barks and barks and pushes the sheep in a certain direction. Same thing a cowboy does with, and a cowboy and his dog, you know, I guess they do with cows. They herd the people in a certain direction. Bernie is herding people into the Democratic Party and into supporting Hillary Clinton. Think about that for a second. Bernie is not as he appears. Bernie is really there as a sheepdog. And it's unfortunate. some people say, well, you know, even with that, Bernie's still winning a lot of new people to socialism, winning a lot of new people to socialist ideas. Well, you know what? When I worked for Ralph Nader in 2008, Ralph used to have a saying. He'd tell people, you know, every single one of the planks in our platform are majoritarian positions. Now, that's Ralph's, you know, Ralph's a lawyer, so he talks kind of lawyerly, but basically that's Ralph's way of saying that the polls show that a majority or even a great majority of the people support this certain position, like single-payer health care, national health care. 60% of Americans back then, in 2008, said that they support single-payer national health care. Not Obamacare, not private health care like Obamacare, you know, pushes, but single-payer national health care. Okay? Well, here's the thing. Just as with Ralph's platform, Ralph's program, we could call it, Bernie's program is all majoritarian positions. And the reason that, that Bernie has all majoritarian positions is all basically the same, a lot of them the same positions as Ralph had, except Ralph was a lot more anti-war than Bernie is. But other than that, at least on domestic issues, Bernie's positions are the same as Ralph's positions, you know? And they were majoritarian positions back then, 2008 and 2004 and 2000, and they're majoritarian positions now. Bernie Sanders